come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Failing to learn the lessons of history. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest today, and this is going to sound like we're picking up in the middle of a conversation because had a fairly serious failure of a backup hard drive where I store all these audio files in order to keep the main hard drive of our production machine fairly clean of audio. So forgive me if in a moment when we get into the interview here, it sounds like we're starting in the middle because, frankly, we are. Also, the audio is going to sound a little odd because the audio that's recovered from this particular discussion was recorded off the audio feed from Skype instead of through the mixer alone. So it's kind of a compromise, but it was a pretty good discussion, and I hated to lose it, even though we lost maybe the first 5 minutes or so because of the what appears to be a crash on a backup hard drive here. But our guest, the author of a number of books, including probably most notably, As America Has Done to Israel. You'll find him on the web at defendproclaimthefaith.org and usaprophecy.com. Our guest, John McTernan, and as we pick up the conversation here as it was recorded, we were discussing the failure of America to learn from history, and specifically learning from the history recorded in the Bible. As the Hebrews were about to enter the land promised to them by God, there were certain things that God had told them very clearly not to do. And unfortunately, after they got comfortable in the land, fat and happy as it were, they decided to go their own way. Every man decided what was right in his own eyes. In other words, a problem we seem to be having here in America today. And we pick up the conversation with John McTernan as he is sort of laying out the history for us and the examples from which we should have learned.
The Lord tells the Jews, as they're just about to enter the promised land, and he tells them they are not to walk after the ordinances of the Canaanites. So the Canaanites and the Amorites are really the same. They blended together now 400 years later. And those ordinances are listed. And it's basically fornication, adultery, killing children, homosexuality, and then bestiality. That is, when God told Abraham about the iniquity of the Amorites, that's what he was talking about. So 400 years later, the Jews are coming back into the promised land, and they now are the God's instrument of judgment against the Canaanites because they live in those ordinances. Mm-hmm. One more thing I want to add to this is, what is an ordinance? Now, according to the Bible, an ordinance is a law. It's a law, but it's also custom. So the Canaanites had customs of sin. And I'll give you a perfect example today. Perfect example today is Gay Pride Day. There is an event that takes place in New Orleans every year during Labor Day weekend. And I'm not making this up. This is what it's called, Southern Decadence.
Yeah.
That's what it's called. See, these are ordinances. They're customs that have taken place. In Florida, at Disneyland, every this time of the year, right at this time of the year, they have like a whole weekend just for homosexuals. See, now that's an ordinance. So our society now is riddled with these ordinances. And who blushes at fornication? I mean, it's promoted in the schools. You know, Planned Parenthood gets in there. They promote fornication. Adultery, we have gone so far with adultery that if you have a marriage, and it doesn't matter, the woman is faithful and the man is an adulterer and it's going into a divorce, the fact that he's an adulterer doesn't carry any weight in a divorce. You know, it's like, does he eat his children too? You know, it's amazing. So you've got like in it, a woman's going to divorce a man for adultery, but in sorting out the divorce and custody of kids and all that, the fact that he was an adulterer doesn't mean anything. That's Now, I can only go by for the state I live in and people I've talked to. I don't know how it is in other states. So there's something wrong with that equation. And what it is adultery is nothing. It's like, it's just nothing. So we have absorbed this into our culture, fornication, adultery. Now, the ordinance for killing children was made in January of 1973. When the Supreme Court made Roe versus Wade, that was an ordinance. I call it, instead of the ordinance of the Amorites, I call it the ordinances of the Americans. Hmm. And as a result of that ordinance, approximately 57 million babies have been legally murdered in the United States. Their blood cries out for judgment. And now we've...
You wouldn't take medicine without checking
what
the
is that?
Hey, honey.
Hang on here. Let me.
Well, the good news is my hypertension's gone.
I have no
idea. So why would you invest?
Goodbye.
Check your broker.
Could be a browser if you got a browser open in your browser.
I closed it. I just closed what I think could be doing it. Can you save? Can you tell me where we are?
You're talking about the ordinances of the Americans. 57 million killed since Roe v. Wade, 1973.
All right. So it's a progression. You know, it first started with fornication, and then it led into divorce, adultery. Then it led into divorce. Then it's led into open pornography. Then it's led into homosexuality, and it's got abortion. So it's a progression through. Really, you could say it kind of started right after World War II. The fornication and all really started after World War II. Then you throw birth control into it. And what we have now is a society that by and large, and in certain states in particular, are completely given over to the ordinance of the Amorites, the Americans. And the Supreme Court now is on the verge of legalizing homosexuality, which is an ordinance. So we have structured our society now in complete rebellion against God's word. And this is what triggers judgment. When the children of Israel were brought into the land, God told them that they were going to judge the Canaanites. The Canaanites are thrown off the land for committing these sins, calls it these iniquities. And God warned the Jews, the children of Abraham, not to do the same sins or you'll be thrown off the land. And that's why Israel was judged in 600 BC by the Babylonians, because they lived in the ordinances of the Amorites, just like the Canaanites did before them.
It is disturbing. I remember when my daughter was young, we had a routine where every morning before school, we'd read some scripture. And just to familiarize her with the Word of God and what God had determined was right and what was wrong. And we get to some of those passages in Leviticus where some of those ordinances of the Canaanites are described. And I had to point out to her, you know, God wasn't trying to invent things here for people not to do. He was telling them, don't do these things, some really detestable things, as you described them, homosexuality, incest, bestiality, because the Canaanites were practicing those things. Here in America, we've gotten to the point where you already mentioned the 57 million estimated that have died since Roe v. Wade. In California, the courts there are, the legislature in California is on the verge of legalizing an assisted suicide law. We've already seen this in Canada, other nations around the world. We're turning into a culture of death.
Death and destruction.
Where human life has no intrinsic value. What historical precedents do we see for this type of value on human life? The idea that we only have value if we are somehow productive, a sort of a utilitarian view of human life.
Yeah, that utilitarian, that goes right back to Nazi Germany. That's only 70 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, Nazi Germany, you had value if you were productive for the state. So, mostly we focus on what the Nazis did to the Jews, but there was a whole other agenda they had. And they, before they started to kill the Jews, they went after like the disabled World War I vets, and they called them like useless eaters of food.
Mm-hmm.
they first started to marginalize them. Then they went after, like, handicapped kids, kids that were Down syndrome, spina bifida, retarded, and all. They would come and pick the kids up. They'd come to, like, a person's house, and they'd say, oh, we have this special hospital where we're going to take them and treat them and maybe make them better. And then the parents would get a letter about 6 weeks later saying, we're sorry, but your son Wilhelm developed pneumonia and passed away. They were euthanizing him. Then the heart of the Nazis, as far as euthanasia and developing mass killing, were the psychiatrists. And they started to kill schizophrenic patients in gas chambers. Mm-hmm. And the SS thought it was so good that they expanded it into the concentration camps, and that's how they begin to mass kill the Jews. So, yeah, to kill off the weak and the old is really at the heart of the Nazis. And what they did was society was prepared for the killing emotionally. And it was no big deal. Abortion, although abortion was illegal in Germany, it was done rampant and open, and no one was really prosecuted for it. They killed the World War I vets. They were killing the handicapped. They were killing the schizophrenic patients. So with that mindset, it was very easy to switch over to for political. You know, once society was accepted all that killing, then killing the Jews and people who supported them and things like that, or they called them haters of Germany, and it was described as a psychosis. So they were already killing the schizophrenics. So then it was very easy for the German medical society and all to go along with killing the Jews and political people that didn't follow the Nazi agenda. So yeah, that's how it started in Germany. It just all of a sudden one day, they're killing millions of people. It was a progression, and society was soft and allowed that progression till it ended up with the gas chambers.
Boiling the frog by degrees. Is proof of the old saying that, who is it, Santa Anna, I guess, that those who fail to learn from history are condemned to repeat it or something. I think that's a paraphrase of what he said. But as you point out, we're looking just back two generations. I mean, in my mother's lifetime, you know, World War II occurred after my mother was born. So she remembers, you know, vaguely, you know, what was going on. She was a little girl at that period of time. But we're talking about within the living memory of many people who are still walking around on planet Earth today, the legacy of the Nazis. And yet that drive to create a better race of humanity, the master race, by eliminating the weak, the defective, which incidentally was based on their final solution program was essentially based on the eugenics program that was in place in the state of California back in the early 1930s.
Well, you're absolutely right, and this is a secret that's kind of been kept swept under the rug. Mm-hmm. And the Nazis were the eugenics had actually started here,
right?
And like Margaret Sanger, for example, head of Planned Parenthood, she called them weeds. She called them weeds, and she wanted, like, what we would call concentration camps, where criminals would be put in and mentally retarded, and you'd be sterilized and wouldn't be able to be reproduce and all. And there was a whole bunch of people with her, and I don't want to get too much into it, but they were in Great Britain, they were here in the United States, and they started to enact some of these laws in here in the United States. Now, I'm going to tell you a little secret, and if I ever had time, I'd like to write a book on this. The underlying factor for eugenics and Nazis' superior race, both in Germany and actually throughout the world and here in the United States, was evolution. Mm-hmm. Evolution has wreaked havoc on the Earth. And when you read the early the Scopes trial, okay, back in the 1920s in Tennessee, and today people, those Christian fundamentalists and creation, and they were trying to suppress evolution and all. I read the book that trial was based upon, and in the book, they had the superiority of the Caucasian race because of evolution.
Right.
They sequenced it down, and then they got to the bottom was the blacks. And that mindset had grasped the intelligentsia in the United States and Germany and Europe. It was rampant. So what was the foundation for eugenics in the United States? What was the foundation for Hitler's master race? Evolution. Mm-hmm. Hitler thought that he was speeding up evolution and, you know, the survival of the fittest. Right. And they suppress that today. They don't want any connection to that today. But the root of the anti-black movement, because I wondered why after the Civil War, I could see the hardness towards the blacks in the South. I could understand that, but it was way beyond the blacks, the South. It was in Indiana, and it was Ohio. You had the Ku Klux Klan. It spread and all, and I was wondering, what caused this? And my study, it went right to evolution, because when did Darwin's thesis come out?
Well, just after the Civil War, yeah.
Right at the time of the Civil War. And then it was picked up by the intelligentsia, and it was taught to the kids in school, and it was the superiority of the white race based on evolution. And that is all suppressed today. They won't let you talk about it, but that's the root of eugenics. And Hitler took that, ran with that whole thing. The whole thing of the Nazi superior race and eugenics is all based on evolution.
That's right. He carried it to its logical conclusion. And that's my point. And that's why I think this discussion, you know, kind of looking at history and the lessons that we're failing to draw from history is important. I asked the presidential candidate on the transhumanist party ticket, Zoltan Istvan. He's the author of a book called The Transhumanist Wager. He's running for president on the transhumanist party ticket in 2016. If the term self-directed evolution was a fair way to describe the transhumanist movement, and he agreed that, yes, that was fair. And I thought that was a fair question to ask, because when you look at the website of another of the leading lights in the transhumanist movement, Dr. Natasha Vita Moore uses that phrase to describe the movement on her website. But the interesting thing, and again, this is where a failure to learn from history leads people to repeat the mistakes of history, and why I believe that there's more than just human agents at work here. We're dealing with the principalities and the powers and the rulers.
Well, I agree with you 100%.
That when you look at the materials that were handed out at the international eugenics conferences in 1922 and 1932, both of which were held at the Natural Museum, the Museum of Natural History in New York City. And presided over by Americans, the official posters for those eugenics conferences were a tree showing the various branches of science, all stemming from one one basic root system, with eugenics essentially being the pinnacle of scientific endeavor. And the motto of both of those conferences was self-directed evolution. And you would think, at least from a standpoint of marketing, that the transhumanists today would avoid that phrase like the plague. But the fact that they aren't even aware of it is disturbing to me, and I think somewhat frightening. Because in their desire to do what they think is best for humanity, just like I'm sure from their perspective, the Nazis were
absolutely
righteous men who were doing what needed to be done to establish Germany to its rightful place at the forefront of humanity. The transhumanists they have resurrected the eugenics movement, and I don't think they even know it.
Probably at the top level they do, but at the lower levels, it's like the Masonic Lodge. At the top level, you have a definite cabal, but you get people down below. They have no idea what's up on the top, and I'm sure that that's what the eugenics movement. Now, it's interesting. We didn't plan on getting into this.
No, no.
Gilbert. But I'm from Long Island, New York originally, and not far from where I grew up. And this is in my book, As America's Done to Israel. The very heart of the Nazi movement outside of Germany was on Long Island, New York. It was called Camp Siegfried. And at one point, they had 50, it was the largest Nazi rallies outside of Germany were in Long Island, New York. They had up to 50,000 Nazis. Now, in my book, I have pictures of it because people don't believe me. And that's why I started to do a lot of get a lot of pictures, and I put them in the book because people wouldn't believe that this was happening. Now, added to that, I'm going to say 25 miles, maybe 30 miles from the Nazi headquarters is a place. Now, I have to think of this in my mind. It's called, I just can't, it'll come to me, but it was the eugenics center of maybe the world on Long Island.
Right, right, right. It was financed by the wife of one of the
big Rockefellers. It was financed by the Rockefellers, yeah, yeah. Rockefeller Foundation. And they brought Nazis, eugenicists, here and took them on tours throughout the United States to promote this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And
it was called... Stony Brook is on my mind. It's not Stony Brook. But anyways, that place is still in existence to this day. And after the war, they kind of like just disappeared, but it was or went under the radar. The Rockefeller Foundation was big time behind eugenics. And where is this coming from today? It's a worse cycle than it was. I mean, they were like Neanderthals 80 years ago compared to what today, gene splicing,
right.
You know, the third rail of, I call it the third rail of the third strand in genetics. And I mean, it is just, my mind gets blown with everything there. I can't even keep up with it.
Yeah.
I can't. But today, what they're doing is makes what they were thinking of 80 years ago like kindergarten stuff.
Kids playing with Tinker Toys, right, because now they've got the CRISPR-Cas9 or CRISPR-Cas9 technique for gene editing, which
you can make your own species now.
Yes, and the scary thing about this, and this is where, you know, it really helps that I'm married to a woman who graduated with high honors with a degree in molecular biology. From Indiana University, which, by the way, was the alma mater of David Starr Jordan, who then went out to Stanford, became the chancellor at Stanford, and helped write the eugenics laws that California then transferred over to Nazi Germany.
Wow. Anyway,
she was telling me that, first of all, the CRISPR-Cas9 technique isn't as precise as they would like us to believe it is. There are other changes that take place when you start tinkering with the DNA, other than the ones that they're aiming for. But she said the thing that's really frightening, though, is that the materials, the equipment needed to start your own gene editing lab in your basement costs about $30.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know how kids, when I was a kid, they'd buy us a microscope for Christmas, and we'd have this little 10-power microscope,
right,
and we'd have these slides underneath. You know, look, I'm 67 years old, you know, so that's what we did 60 years ago. I was happy to get this little micro. Now, for $30, you can start your own...
Create your own species.
Yeah. You know, and I this is my opinion, and it's just my opinion. But when you look at Greek mythology, you know, and you had the centaurs and all, I believe now, based on what's happening today, that those things really existed, and these weren't mythology. That because it says in the days of Noah, so also so the coming of the Son of Man be, and we know from Genesis 6 that there was tampering with man's DNA. So I'm sure it wasn't limited to man.
Right. You know, funny thing is, Steve Quayle has been here recently as a guest on Skywatch TV, and you know, he's written a couple of books on these topics, and people think he's crazy. So
it's my opinion. I mean, yeah. I'm not saying it definitely happened, but where would the Greeks get these ideas of the centaurs,
right,
and the chimeras and all of this? And, you know, and when I went to school and whatever I was taught it in, you know, I was just mythology. And I didn't pass anything about remarks. And, you know, now, though, at my age and what I see going on, I'm thinking, you know, maybe that was more than just mythology. Maybe, right, there was something behind that was passed down through the generations that we thought was mythology, but it wasn't. But anyways, that's a different topic.
But again, it relates to what...
Cold Spring Harbor.
That's, yes. I was trying to think of it, too, because I did some research on that for a presentation I gave on transhumanism at...
Cold Spring Harbor was ground zero for the eugenics movement
they kept
in the United States.
They kept family records on thousands and thousands of Americans. When you start doing some research into the eugenics movement of the 1920s, 1930s, you can find pictures online of American families at county fairs that were, they would be set up in an exhibit like you'd set up, you know, prize goats. You know, this is the ideal American family. These are the kind of people we want breeding and making new Americans. But as you point out,
That's Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. She wanted to get rid of, like, if you were an intelligent black person, and I want to be careful how I phrase that. If you were an intelligentsia and you were black, they accepted you. But they wanted to get rid of anybody that was, like, on welfare, anybody that was a useless eater of food, anybody that had a criminal mentality, a low IQ. So it wasn't only blacks that they wanted to get rid of. They wanted to get rid of, like, well, Irish. If the Irish came and they were blaming all the problems in the ghettos and in the cities at this low intelligence, people that couldn't function. So that through eugenics, they wanted to get rid of them, but they were really focused on the blacks. Mm-hmm. I mean, but they also would go after Irish or Italians or anybody that was didn't fit their agenda. And of course, they are going to be leaders. They're the ones that are going, right. And that's the same today.
Yeah,
it's the same. And one thing I just wanted to mention to you and your listeners, this stuff about evolution and transhumanism. When I talk to people about this. And they're serious. I mean, these people are true believers.
Oh, yes.
I'll say to them, do you really think, and you pick a time frame, we'll say 1 million years, do you really think in 1 million years that we would naturally become cyborgs? All of a sudden, we'd start developing, you know, half metal and biological bodies with torsion bars for muscles. Do you really believe that? That somehow we would merge with metal naturally, that through they think they're speeding up, you know, evolution. So naturally in 1 million years, we would become a cyborg. So they're cutting it down now to 20 or 30 or however many years. It's insane. It really is.
No, I agree. You mentioned Margaret Sanger, but her modern day, analog would be Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was asked about the abortion ruling Roe v. Wade, and she said, well, we understood it was to prevent having too many of the kind of people we didn't want too many of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so
that's that arrogance. But you, that mentality can, you see, what the danger of this is, people can think like, oh, right, yeah, the abortion for people on welfare, okay, yeah. But that's what happened with the Nazis. And you got people hardened to killing people on welfare, let's say,
yes.
The babies that come from welfare. The Nazis used that mentality to spread it, to spread it, to spread it. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg despises you and me. Mm-hmm. She is a hard left, I call them reprobates, hard left reprobates. And the worst people in the world to them is me and you and most of your listeners. They despise us. They loathe us. They look at us with the same disdain and hatred that the Nazis had for the Jews.
Yeah.
And if they can use that killing mentality in the United States, eventually it's going to come our way. They hate us, and they're in power now. Obama is very comfortable with meeting Castro and meeting the Chinese and bowing to the king of Saudi Arabia, and he wants to cut deals with Iran. He despises us. We are the source of all evil in the world.
Another interesting trend here in the United States, and I say interesting not necessarily as a good thing, but maybe disturbing is a more accurate word. We have moved, in my opinion, into a post-Christian society, post-Christian culture. The Barna Group survey in 2009, I think, is one I keep coming back to because it's so eye-opening. When I first read it, that 9% of American adults have a biblical worldview, but only 19% of American adults who say that they are committed to Jesus Christ and know that they're going to heaven have a biblical worldview, which means accepting some basic points of doctrine that should be no-brainers for anyone who's, you know, truly a believer in Jesus Christ. The main growth, outreach, around the world where we're seeing people coming to the Lord is not happening here in the United States. It's happening in the southern hemisphere. It's happening on the other side of the planet. And some of your work, John, I wanted to focus on this, is making an impact on the other side of the world. How did this come about? What are you doing? And what sort of things are you hearing?
Well, what happened was the Lord led me, a time now is a blur in the past, but we'll say 10 years ago, maybe a little more, into a ministry of healing the brokenhearted. And I was struggling in the Lord for many years, up and down, and I felt there was something on me like a car with the emergency brake on. I went into these spiritual highs and spiritual lows, and I knew something was wrong, and I was crying out to the Lord, what is it, what is it, what is it? And to make things short, he revealed to me it was a broken heart. It goes back to when I was a child. My mother and father were divorced. My mother's remarriage didn't go over good, and it had a big impact on me. And so I grew up with a broken heart that when I came to the Lord, my heart was still broken, and I didn't know it. So the Lord healed my heart. And then I just one by one, I'd be in a Bible study, and I'd look at this person, and the Lord would say, he's got a broken heart, pray for him. So I would just go over and talk to the person, and she's got a broken heart. And the ministry just got bigger and bigger. Then I started to pray after a service, because I basically was into prophecy. But afterwards, I would say, anybody who wants to be healed for a broken heart, please come forward. But that got bigger and bigger. And then I started to have services just for the brokenhearted. And then I was on Sid Roth, and the ministry got bigger and bigger. And there's a whole huge percentage of believers in Jesus Christ that are going around just like I was, with a broken heart and didn't know it. It is incredible. I have prayed now individually for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and spoken publicly for thousands, and seen the Lord do remarkable things for healing the broken heart. And that's the foundation. We come to the Lord first for salvation, then the broken heart, then it's come to preach deliverance to the captives. And what we're doing is we're going after the captivity part, but the foundation of that is a broken heart. So the heart must be healed first. Then people get freed of depression. Then they get freed of anxiety. Then they get freed of alcohol and drugs. I've come to see alcohol and drugs as self-medication for a broken heart.
Sure.
Really. So what happened was, I was thinking about, I said, I got to get this message out beyond me. And I'm going to write a book, because I am an author. And then, I mean, the Lord stopped me in the tracks, and he said, no, a brochure. A brochure, not a book. Because a small fraction of people will read a book. But, you know, if you have to do a brochure nice and it looks nice, you can have an infinite number of people that will read it. So I wrote a brochure titled, Jesus Christ Came to Heal the Brokenhearted. And I started to distribute it. And I started to get fantastic feedback about it here in the United States. And somehow it got to Pakistan, it got to India, it got to Uganda. Now, it's gotten all over the world, but these countries it's really exploded in. India, Pakistan, Kenya, Uganda, and now we're really starting to move into Nigeria. So the Lord hooked me up with a ministry in India that has a printing press. And they first said, we're going to print this brochure and another brochure I have titled The 666 Surveillance System. Right now, they're printing another 100,000 of the Brokenhearted brochure. They'll be distributing them in the end of the month. And we have, in just about a year, distributed 600,000 in India.
Wow.
600,000. It's been translated into three Indian languages plus English. Incredible reports of Muslims coming to the Lord, Hindus coming to the Lord. In Pakistan, we've distributed about 30,000, maybe a little more in Pakistan. Hindus coming to the Lord. I didn't even know there were Hindus in Pakistan. I thought it was, you know, all Muslim.
Yeah,
but there's Hindus, Muslims come to the Lord. Now, this year, I still have a problem wrapping my brain around this, Gilbert. But through my contact in Pakistan, he has set up Skype and with a PowerPoint projector. So I've preached three times now live in Pakistan, sitting at my desk here in Pennsylvania, preaching to Hindus and Muslims. I just preached last Saturday. I don't know how many I want. The only thing I can preach on is John 3:16. That's what I preach on, plus the blood of the everlasting covenant, which means the healed heart, salvation, the healed heart, and God is your Abba Father. So of all the people that got saved last Saturday, eight Hindus wanted to be immediately baptized. So Sunday, they immediately baptized eight Hindus from the preaching that Jesus Christ came to heal the brokenhearted. Now, the same thing is happening in Kenya. The same thing is happening in Uganda. And I'm starting an international ministry called Abba Fathers International Fellowship. And we've got preachers and churches lining up in India and Pakistan and Uganda and Kenya. Here in the United States, it's also in Holland, in Great Britain, in Australia, in Canada. It's all through. It's all because of this brochure, Jesus Christ Came to Heal the Brokenhearted. So it was a blessing for me to write the brochure and not the book, because with the brochure, I could reach millions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's going on now. And, you know, I hear people say, well, there's no revival coming because of the day we live in and all. It's, well, just go to India and see what's going on in India with the Lord. And go to China. And you heard of the earthquake there in Nepal?
Yes.
2 months before that earthquake, we sent 30,000 of the brokenhearted brochures to Nepal. There was an evangelist from India that goes all through Nepal, and he took 30,000. One man, one ministry took 30,000 and distributed them all through Nepal about 2 months before the earthquake hit.
Hmm. It's timely and needed, and it sounds to me as though the places in the world that are being most impacted by this are the places where people understand their needs better than we do here in the United States. You talked about drugs and alcohol being a self-medication for a broken heart. We used to live up the street from a youth pastor who worked at an Assemblies of God church in West St. Louis County, which is a rather affluent part of that area. He said it was more difficult ministering there than it was when he worked in one of the poorer suburbs of Chicago, because in the poorer areas, people knew that they were hurting, knew that they were broken, and knew that they needed things. Because they didn't have the opportunity to medicate with drugs, alcohol, or buying shiny toys like a car or fancy tech gadgets and so forth. They basically had all of those props kicked out from underneath them. It sounds to me as though that's where your message or the Lord's message that he's given to you is having the most impact.
I mean, in Kenya, the poverty in Nairobi is beyond anything we can imagine here. And what the people suffer, and when they hear the message that the Lord loves them and wants to heal their heart and wants to live with them as their Abba Father, they readily accept it. I mean, it is something to behold. To see what's going on in India and Pakistan. So, yeah, I'm pretty well out towards, we're heading towards 1 million of the Broken Heart brochures now in just about a year. It was more than a year. Last April, we started to distribute it. So I never did I dream that it would go. And right now, it's being translated into Chinese. It's being translated into Spanish, Farsi, which is from Iran. So, and I think a couple other languages. And I'd like to say, Gilbert, if people would like to contact me, I can send them the brochure free of charge. It's also on my website. They can download it on my website, usaprophecy.com, usaprophecy.com, and they can contact me through the website. I'd be glad to send them some copies of the brochure free.
That's fantastic. one of the areas, and I've, you know, coming back around to some of the issues here in the United States that kind of reflect the falling away from Jesus Christ, the transgender movement. I interviewed a gentleman named Walt Heyer, who is a believer now. He came to the Lord after his gender reassignment surgery, and as an adult, and then discovering several years into living as a woman that his problems hadn't been solved. And if you want to talk about regret, I can only imagine the regret. I can't conceive of the regret that someone in that position would feel, but the difficulty that he had as a person who had thought that the major life change, which now is in the news thanks to Bruce Jenner, discovered that his issues were not resolved by that surgery. The kind of regret that would engulf you at that point is certainly of the enemy seeking to destroy. And he was fortunate, blessed, to find a pastor who was willing to open up and talk to him. And basically, it seems to me, present the message that you're presenting, that Jesus Christ is the only way to heal a heart that is broken, that is damaged.
Only way. See, the broken heart is spiritual. And there's no amount of therapy that can heal a broken heart. There is no amount of drugs. And what we've done today within Christian circles is we've gone through, there's books, I call them self-help books. There's books, 3 steps to this, 5 steps to this, 8 steps to this, 10 steps to this. And what they're doing is they're really dancing around the issue that the person has a broken heart. And these books, these self-helps, are like how to manage it. And I'll give you an example of this. I've prayed with numbers of women who've had abortions, numbers. And several of them have gone through some 8-step program. And one woman in a church that I spoke in, she was one of the leaders I'm not putting them down. I believe that they're doing the very best they think they could do. So there's no way that I'm trying to slight them. But the women that have gone through these programs, I've said, well, did anyone ever pray with you for the healing of a broken heart? Never once, with all that I prayed for, did they ever say yes. Never once. So I said, well, then this is part of the problem. This is why you're depressed. This is why you're having panic attacks and trauma. You've been traumatized by the abortion, and your heart has not been healed. So we pray, and I've seen miraculous things that God has done with healing the broken heart. So the issue is a broken heart, and we're dancing around. What? Why has the church dropped the ball on this, Gilbert? I scratch my head, I look at it, and it's all these books out there, psychologists and drugs, but it's simple. It cuts right down to the ministry of Jesus Christ found in Isaiah 61, 1 through 3, and Luke 4:18. And the danger with Luke 4:18 is many of the modern translations take out of it that he came to heal the broken heart. That's out of the modern translations. So, that's the ministry now that the Lord has really got me into. And it's an exciting ministry to see people being set free, bondage all their lives, and being set free.
Yeah, it's like a burden lifted off your shoulders when you understand the love that the Creator of the universe has for us, that knowing from the beginning of time that we would be sinful and rebellious and still chose to come walk among us and be sacrificed for us.
Well, he wants to live with us as his, and that he is our Abba Father. Now, some of you listeners may not know what Abba means. It's Hebrew for daddy. And, you know, Gilbert, there's a big difference the way my father dealt with me when I was 6 years old and when I was 30 years old. Yeah. He's still my father, right? But when I was 6 years old, if I was afraid, I'd say, you know, in English we'd say daddy, but in Hebrew they'd say Abba. You know, and I'd say, Abba, there's a bad man over here. I'm afraid. Yeah, and my dad, like, would pick me up, or he'd hold me on the side. Don't be afraid. He called me Johnny. Don't be afraid, Johnny. Don't be afraid. Or, you know, Abba, I'm really thirsty. You know, or at bedtime, Abba, I'm afraid in the dark. Oh, my father would come and take care of me. Don't be afraid. I mean, a real loving Abba Father on earth, that's what he did. Now, if I was 30 years old and I called my father up and said, Dad, I'm really afraid of this person, he'd say to me, son, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, suck it up.
You're a man. You're 30 years old. You take care of your... Or if I said, Dad, I'm short on money. You know, I need some money. I'm talking about like the way a kid would. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, my dad would tell me, he said, son, get another job. That's what he... But he wouldn't tell me that at 6 years old.
Yeah.
You see the difference? If I called my dad up and said, Dad, I'm afraid at night of the dark... He would think I lost my mind, but at 6 years old, you know, he comforts me. But God's relationship with us is he wants to have a relationship that he is our Abba Father, not merely Father God, because there's a difference when we're 30 years old and we're 6 years old. He wants that relationship. And when we see him as Abba Father, there's no fear there. There's no fear.
But John, again, where do people go? They like to get a copy of the brochure, find out more about this new ministry, the Abba Father International Fellowship.
They can. It's very easy. They can go to usaprophecy.com. usaprophecy.com. Everything that I have is there. My blogs are there. My books are there. I have radio shows. Tonight we have prayer. It's called Prayer of the Solemn Assembly, and we cry out in repentance to the Lord. If people aren't in a church that's doing that and they want prayer, we're available every Tuesday and Thursday night. Everything is there at usaprophecy.com.
John McTernan, radio host, author, and evangelist, and having a global impact.
Evangelist to Pakistan, and I've never been in Pakistan, and I preach live. I mean, can you? I still have a problem wrapping my brain around that. And what happens is, they turn the monitor around so I can see the crowd, and they put me on top of a podium. So, and the kids are always up front, and I can look out and see the kids, and I'll wave to them, and they're looking at me and they wave back. Isn't that bizarre?
It's amazing.
Then they have a PowerPoint screen, and behind me they project. They hold up a bedroom sheet, you know, a bed sheet. That's their screen. And they project it so a big crowd can see it. So it's live. I'm sitting home in Pennsylvania preaching live to Muslims and Hindus in Pakistan and winning them to the Lord.
That's incredible. Knowing that God does not need you or me to wield his sword or preach his word, to be used in that way by the Holy Spirit is truly humbling and quite an honor.
Well, it is. It is.
John, thanks very much for your time today. Really appreciated your conversation. I look forward to talking with you again.
Okay. God bless you and your listeners.
I'll put links in the show notes at vftb.net as to where you can find John McTernan online, usaprophecy.com. Also, defendproclaimthefaith.org. Find out more about what John is doing and hear his comments and join in his online prayer sessions as we Christians often fail to deploy the most effective weapon we have in that spiritual war. And I am certainly guilty of that as charged. We want to use the ballot box. We want to use rhetoric on the internet. We want to use Twitter and Facebook to make our points. Again, and I'm speaking for myself here, the idea that perhaps prayer is the first weapon of choice in the spiritual war is usually something I forget. So kudos to John for making that a regular part of his online ministry. Speaking of spiritual warfare, there was an event that was reported this week by the Catholic News Agency and then spread around the web a little bit that I thought was significant. And I plan to do some more programs on this because this raises some interesting questions in my mind. Back on May the 20th, in a closed-door ceremony at the Cathedral of San Luis Potosi in Mexico, Cardinal Juan Sandoval Iniguez, and forgive my pronunciation, presided over a ceremony called Exorcismo Magno, or the Great Exorcism. Now, guiding this great exorcism was a Spanish demonologist and exorcist, Father Jose Antonio Fortea. The purpose was to drive away demons from the entire country of Mexico. If you pay attention to the news at all, you know that Mexico has suffered from a wave of violence in recent years, especially since the previous president launched a really aggressive crackdown on the drug cartels that operate out of Mexico and supply the rest of North America with illegal narcotics. The cardinal and the archbishop of San Luis Potosi linked the increase in violence and illegal activity in Mexico to the legalization of abortion, which was legalized in 2007, or at least it was legalized on a state-by-state basis. Some of the states in Mexico are more liberal in that regard than others. Over 100,000 abortions have been performed in the last 8 years, which is just a drop in the bucket compared to what we've seen here in America since Roe v. Wade. Anyway, the point of the ritual, again, was to drive the demons away from Mexico. Now, Roman Catholics believe, or at least Roman Catholics in Mexico believe, I should say, painting with a broad brush isn't quite accurate. But in general, it is believed that demons had the run of Mexico until the Marian apparition witnessed by Juan Diego in December of 1531, and that was Our Lady of Guadalupe. And after that miraculous apparition, which is endorsed by the Roman Catholic Church, demons were, it is reported, run out of Mexico, but that the legalization of abortion 8 years ago has allowed them access back in. That is the belief of those who were participating in this ceremony anyway. So Father Fortea, the demonologist, and a group of exorcists from around Mexico performed this ceremony. Now, the questions that come to my mind are these. First of all, can you exorcise demons from a geographic location? I know that there are places where groups of Christians gathering together will perform what's called an exorcism of place to require any demonic spirits to leave the assembly. But can you exorcise demons from a city, from a county, from a state, from a country, especially when the country is home to one of the fastest growing occult belief systems in the Western world? And that is the cult of Santa Muerte, or Saint Death, which has millions of followers in Mexico and now in the United States as well. Is that effective? Secondly, when you're dealing with a territorial spirit, and I believe there's some scriptural support for the idea that there are perhaps not demons, but maybe fallen angels that are responsible for certain territories, certain people groups. It certainly would fit the divine council paradigm, the post-Babel, Tower of Babel divine council paradigm. Are you, as a human, in a ritual of the type employed by the Roman Catholic Church, going to achieve anything by trying to evict a spirit of that rank? Or are you just going to invite spiritual retribution upon yourself? And there's some evidence from deliverance ministers that there are certain ranks in the spirit realm that you have to be very careful with, because trying to evict them without proper prayer and fasting might invite retribution upon yourself, might invite blowback, if you will. So I've got some queries out to gentlemen who've done more work in this field than I have. I'm certainly no theological expert. And hopefully we can find out more about this and do a couple of programs on this here in the near future. Can you exorcise spirits from a geographic area? And if you're dealing with a territorial spirit, a fallen angel or watcher, would such a ritual be effective? Those are the questions on my mind. Other things in the news, the European Space Agency's comet probe, the Philae lander, which landed on Comet 67P. And then there's some Russian names that I can't pronounce after that. But Comet 67P landed in November, but its claws failed to hook onto the landing spot, and it slid into a shaded area, and the solar batteries discharged pretty quickly after that. So Philae went to sleep. It woke up here this past week, as it is now closer to the sun and the batteries have recharged. Researchers are, of course, looking to find organic compounds on the comet to try to prove a theory that life on Earth began when a comet with organic compounds on it smashed into the planet. They're trying to prove panspermia. So, by now you've heard of the The transracial NAACP, former NAACP chapter president, Rachel Dolezal, I don't want to make light because she is being dissected in the social media, 140 characters at a time, but her story is so unusual that it is fascinating to try to understand what would motivate a blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman of Swiss, German, and Czech descent to try to pass herself off as black, which she did for a number of years, probably the last 7 or 8 years, according to accounts from family members. So I don't want to, you know, mock or ridicule because that doesn't serve any purpose. And at the end of her 15 minutes of fame, which is approaching, I think, pretty quickly here, there are some things that will remain. First of all, the people who she wanted to help, apparently, for whatever reason, have had their cause somewhat tarnished by her deception. The police in Spokane, Washington, suspended all investigations into the claims of racial harassment that she filed, including one where reportedly she claimed that she received hate mail, or the NAACP chapter received hate mail at their P.O. box. Upon investigation, police found that there was no barcode on the mail, which meant it didn't go through the post office system, which means either one of the three postal employees with access to the box put it there, and they were all investigated and cleared by the police department, or somebody with the key to the post office box put it in the box, or it was never in the box at all. So that doesn't help the cause. And so the people who trusted her and elected her to that position of leadership in the local NAACP chapter, they're hurting. Obviously, her family members are hurting. If you've seen the interviews with her parents and with most of her adopted siblings anyway, they are really at a loss to explain why Rachel Dolezal has estranged herself from her family for the last 7, 8 years, claimed that a black man that she's not related to is her birth father, when in fact, Larry Dolezal, her father, is clearly a guy of European descent like me. So it's an unusual story, and again, it's a sad one because at the end of the 15 minutes of fame, there are people who are going to be hurting here, and so I don't want to pile on. One thing that has been very interesting to watch is how the progressives who rushed to congratulate Bruce Jenner on his courage and bravery for declaring that he is a woman, in spite of all the biological evidence, are turned around and piled on Rachel Dolezal for claiming that she is African American, a claim for which there is a lot less contradictory biological evidence than Bruce Jenner's claim. At the very least, what it does is it shows how foolish racial discrimination is, that we will make determinations about people based on the amount of melanin in their skin. And especially as Christians, we need to remember that for those of us who've accepted Jesus Christ, as the Apostle Paul wrote, there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, and I would add neither black nor white, for we're all one in Christ Jesus. Sadly, it appears that according to research data, that the end of Christianity in the West is already being proclaimed. Census data from England shows that the number of Christians born there over the last 10 years or so has dropped at a rate that if you projected ahead, it dropped at such a sharp rate that if you projected ahead, Christianity will be statistically insignificant in the UK within 50 years, by about the year 2067. Now, statistical projections are not predictions, but it's a sad trend. Here in the U.S., Pew Research just did a study and found that a similar trend is underway in the United States. Only 57% of people between the ages of 18 and 34 self-identify as Christians in the U.S. now, and 36% of 18 to 24-year-olds call themselves nuns. In other words, no religious affiliation whatsoever. So when you see statistics like that, it's no surprise that you've got people turning out in droves for UFO conferences looking for answers to the big questions of life. Where did we come from? Why are we here? And where do we go when we die? And finally, tomorrow, Thursday, will be the day Pope Francis officially releases his encyclical, his papal encyclical on the climate that has been leaked already and published at an Italian newspaper. The Vatican is furious. It indicates there is some infighting perhaps going on within the Vatican. Those who are not on board with the climate change agenda. There is something a little disturbing about this, beside the fact that the Pope is calling for essentially a global authority to enforce the lifestyle changes needed to reduce our carbon output. One of the presenters with Pope Francis on Thursday is a Professor John Schnellenhuber, who's the founding director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Schnellenhuber has called for stabilizing the Earth's population at a sustainable level of about 1 billion people. The problem is that would mean eliminating about 7 billion. Schnellenhuber has also called for an Earth Charter that would transcend the United Nations, essentially looking for a one-world government. And the Pope has chosen this gentleman to be one of three presenters with him as he releases that papal encyclical. So, we don't mean to be too tinfoil hatty here, but when you put that together, it looks an awful lot like the Pope signing on to the idea of a one-world government. And, of course, I expect, seeing the Vatican as playing a dominant role in the religious component of the one-world government. Again, that's me speculating. I'm not necessarily convinced that the Roman Catholic Church is the woman in scarlet riding the beast, but certainly there are those who would interpret his actions and the call for a one-world government to enforce climate change in that light. So coming up on A View from the Bunker, we're still looking at a couple of guests to talk about the issue of the Exorcismo Magno. Hopefully we can do that here in the next few days, maybe get two or three shows out of that with various folks, just to get a better sense of what the supernatural realm is like. Are there ranks within the angelic realm? And if so, what are they? How do we interpret those? What do we actually know about the spirit realm from Scripture? And how far can we extrapolate beyond that before we get fall outside the bounds of Christian orthodoxy? So hopefully we'll be able to pull those together soon. Also, still hoping to confirm an appointment or confirm a time to talk with Reverend Dr. Christopher Benick about Christian transhumanism and why he believes that the time has come for Christians to embrace the transhumanist movement. His view is a little more nuanced than the atheistic transhumanists that I've spoken to, and I'm sure different from the Mormon transhumanist, Lincoln Cannon, that I spoke to not long ago. So hopefully we'll be able to pull those together within the next couple of weeks. The Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly online Bible study, will be posted again Sunday morning. We've gone to a podcast-only version of that. We're working our way through the book of Leviticus now, and that will be posted by mid-morning this coming Sunday at Gilbert House. Org. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.